You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So in the president's budget, there's a lot of numbers. I'm sure you must have seen them. But it really chronicles also the transformation of the Pentagon into a power-projecting force in the Pacific rather than the Atlantic. It shows that that transformation is well underway, as well as the other radical long-term change in the Defense Department. The budget shows that it wants to focus less on big armies and more on small tactical units and special operations forces, a policy that's been continued really for a couple of decades now. It was special operations forces that killed Osama bin Laden last year. Special ops are responsible for most of the high-profile U.S. military successes of the past decade. Ironically, most of the successes of the big army, big navy Pentagon are associated with humanitarian relief efforts and those sorts of logistical exercises. The U.S. Special Operations Command has the same standing now as CENTCOM and PACCOM. Central Command, of course, is in the Middle East. The Pacific Command is PACCOM. It's run by Special Ops Com is run by a four-star Navy Admiral, William McCraven. He's its ninth commander, and he wants to make USOC even bigger, with more autonomy and a bigger global reach. Mark Ambender is a contributing editor at GQ and The Atlantic. He's also author of The Command. It's an ebook about the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command. Welcome to the program, Mark.
It's good to be here.
So this is a pretty fascinating book that you've written here because it really tells a story that on its face seems to be a contradiction. Special ops has its roots in a kind of shadowy secrecy, and yet the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command is trying to gain a higher and higher profile and, in fact, might even be the template for the entire 21st century Pentagon by the end of this century. There won't be an Army, Navy, Marine Corps kind of organization. How can it do both, be secret and have this kind of a profile?
And that's one of the biggest challenges it faces. When Admiral McCraven not yet a flag officer in the 1990s, he actually wrote a book called Spec Ops, where he pointed out this very trade-off, which is the trade-off between stealth and size on the one hand the ability to do the ability to stealth and size, which makes an operation much more efficient and allows you to use very, very highly specialized skills. The larger the force, the harder it is to use these skills. And here he is now advocating for a large-scale expansion of Special Operations Command. I think one misnomer, though, is people associate Special Operations Command with JSOC, which is a small part of what the Special Operations Command usually does.
And indeed, your book, The Command, is about JSOC, and we should remind people that is the Joint Special Operations Command, and it, in a sense, precedes the U.S. Joint Special Operations Commands in that it was a handpicked group of combat soldiers from each of the disciplines with their equipment to conduct very special operations that reports directly to the president. What is distinctive about JSOC?
We call it the president's secret army. And although that sounds rather grand in the title that a publisher might give a book to sell the book, it truly reflects JSOC's legal position in the chain of command. The president can directly order the commander of JSOC to mount an operation using what's called national mission forces. That's one part of what JSOC does. National mission forces conduct highly specialized operations that might include, for example, disabling a nuclear weapon somewhere or foreign irregular warfare, which is basically a way of saying going inside a country and maybe spying on one of the country's military installations.
Or even rescuing a young woman from Somali pirates.
Rescuing a young woman from Somali pirates or killing the most wanted terrorist in the world. What McRaven envisions actually is something else that JSOC does, which it provides for combatant commanders, which are, as you say, all of the regional commanders, the commander of CENTCOM, the commander of the Pacific Command, with a force multiplier, in a sense, a task force that they can use at a moment's notice to tamp down a particular crisis in their area of operation. At that moment, the JSOC forces actually report to and are subordinate to the combatant commander. And if you'll recall back a couple of years when David Petraeus was the commander of CENTCOM, he used Joint Special Operations Command task forces, not simply in Afghanistan and Iraq, but throughout the Horn of Africa as a way to help gather intelligence and to keep an eye on and essentially to keep the lawn mowed when it comes to Al-Qaeda on that continent. And he did so using relatively new authorities that the Obama administration had granted. And what
Let's explore that, because that's pretty interesting. Mark Ambinder is contributing editor at GQ and in The Atlantic. He's the author of The Command. It's an ebook about U.S. Joint Special Operations Command. So under the McCraven model that you describe in your book, basically combatant commanders, generals on the ground or colonels even possibly on the ground, would have the ability to call out JSOC if there's a crisis on the Pakistani border, or if there's even an intelligence issue 1,000 miles away that combatant commander believes is relevant to his own theater.
Well, the combatant commander would be, you know, a 4-star admiral or general. But the principle essentially is correct. JSOC would be a global strike force of sorts. In the same way that the U.S. can launch a missile anywhere in the world, not a nuclear missile, hopefully, but a conventional missile anywhere in the world for a pinpick strike. JSOC can be launched essentially from anywhere in the world to anywhere in the world in a very short period of time to take care of a very acute situation. And over the past 10 years, the force has seen itself quadruple in size and seen the resources it's been given quintuple in size in order to put itself in a position to do that.
If I'm a president, Mark Ambinder, and I'm faced with calling out an invasion force where I have to deal with the Pentagon bureaucracy and Congress, really, versus going to JSOC, my sort of personal militia here, and ordering some sort of night strike, obviously I'm going to go to JSOC. It seems to me the trend line is only for more and more growth from the White House perspective of something like JSOC.
And the trend line is for more and more integrated operations with JSOC, SOCOM, and the intelligence agencies all working together. But it's much easier under the law for the president, in a sense, to call out the military than it is for the president simply to say to the CIA, go into this country and make mischief. In order to do that, the president needs to create a finding, which he needs to present to Congress, which presents for the president a number of issues. And one of the questions and concerns I raise in my book is about oversight of JSOC and some of the trade-offs there. Because on the one sense, you want to have a very agile force that can respond at a moment's notice without Congress putting its nose into every single operational detail. But at this point, there don't exist the accountability mechanisms that would allow that to take place.
It's almost a nearly pre-authorized military force, JSOC is, for the president. Before we go, what is the most extraordinary capability you found at JSOC, or at least that they imagine having?
That's a great question. I would say that probably it's their capacity to render safe a nuclear weapon or spoof a nuclear weapon so that somebody who has one thinks that it's a real nuclear weapon, but it's not really a nuclear weapon, or in some of the more extreme contingency plans they have, disable or attempt to disable an entire country's nuclear arsenal, which has never been attempted before, but in the case of Pakistan, is certainly one of the on-the-shelf plans that exists. In the Pentagon, and which, if you think about it, it's just it would take an extraordinary, it's an extraordinary thing to contemplate.
Did it reassure you that they have this capability, or make you nervous?
Well, it does both, of course. I think it makes Pakistan extreme. In fact, I know it makes Pakistan extremely nervous, and it, of course, makes the U.S. very nervous to talk about it. But I think the fact that it really has never been exercised in that way, although there have been plenty of incidents that we have never really heard of or haven't come to light, where JSOC has recovered a nuclear weapon or has tricked a country, has found a nuclear weapon, taken all the nuclear stuff out of it, and convinced the country that has it or a group that has it that they still have it. That's happened several times in the past 10 years. That's scary, John.
That's scary. That is scary. Mark Ambender is contributing editor at GQ and The Atlantic, author of the very scary The Command, an ebook about U.S. Joint Special Operations Command. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure. Good to be.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.